Hello, and welcome back to the Dive and Dig News podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports the development of maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. This week, I'm going to be talking to a friend and colleague, Dr. Dan Pascoe of Pascoe Archaeology, who has been undertaking, I would say for quite some years now, research around the waters of the UK. He's particularly a specialist in shipwrecks, in fact, naval warfare. And in the Solent region, where he's been conducting research over the last couple of years, he's made a new discovery. And here is Dan to tell you all about the Edgar. Dan, excellent. It's really nice. Thank you so much for joining us on the Dive and Dig News podcast. I hear we do actually have some really exciting news. You've made a new discovery. Is that correct?
Yes. Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for having me. Yes, we discovered a new Royal Navy shipwreck off Portsmouth called the Edgar that blew up in 1711.
Wow, 1711. All right. So this isn't just... I mean, ordinarily when we make new discoveries, they're slightly later, you know, historically, but that's really quite early. How did you find it?
I'm into Royal Navy shipwrecks, and it all starts out as personal research. I don't want to just be an archaeologist that turns up on other people's sites. I really want to find a new shipwreck, so I thought, started looking. I live in Southampton, near Portsmouth, started looking at sites that might be nearby, and I started reading. You've heard of Alexander McKee, who found the Mary Rose.
Absolutely.
When I started reading his book on how he found the Mary Rose, he spoke about other sites in the Solent region, Royal Navy shipwrecks, such as the Royal George that blew up in the 1780s, the Boyne slightly later, and of course, the Mary Rose, which was 1545, and that was the main aim of his project, Solent ships. He also mentioned another ship called the Edgar. But when they found the Mary Rose, all interest in the other shipwrecks sort of waned for obvious reasons. And although they found the Royal George and the Boyne, the Edgar was pretty much, I think, forgotten about. And I don't think they even dived it. So that was the first site that I thought, well, this is, you know, a potentially interesting site. It's a warship from 1711, a 70-gun warship, so it's not a small ship. So I thought, let's start there. We've got a rough location from old charts.
So what caused the Edgar to blow up? Is this battle? What are we talking about here?
That's a very good question. Actually, we know quite a lot about it because there was a court-martial. So the Edgar was at anchor in Spithead, which is a naval anchorage, and that's where ships anchor when they come to port, or they're waiting to be, stores brought on or stores taken off. The captain had gone ashore for reasons not entirely sure, left the crew and the lieutenants on board. The master gunner with the crew on board were cleaning out the after gunpowder room and transferring powder from there into the forward gunpowder room. And we know this because lieutenant and a few of the crew survived the explosion because they weren't on board. The master gunner, when he's finished cleaning the after gunpowder room, he told the lieutenant he's finished it. The lieutenant inspected his work and was satisfied that they did a good job. So the lieutenant, with another lieutenant, left the Edgar to go ashore to see the captain. And they took a number of the crew to row them in the ship's longboats. While they were away, the ship blew up.
It's pretty tragic. I mean, so if you've got... What did you say? It's a 70 gun. So, I mean, how many people would have been crewing this boat? Obviously, some of them are ashore, but the majority, I presume, are still on the ship.
So you've probably got between 200 and 300 crew on board when the ship blew up. I mean, it's a 70 gun warship, so that's a normal amount of crew to have. The officers are all ashore. The senior warrant officer on board was the master gunner, and it was quite normal for him, you know, to take charge of the ship while the officers are away. And, I mean, he would know to be careful around gunpowder. It must have just been a very unfortunate event. Something had caused the powder to go up. And we'll never know what, you know, this is the thing with these. When the ship goes up in a big way, there tends to be not many survivors. And the ones that do survive aren't going to be around the gunpowder at the time. So everyone on board that ship went down with the ship. The only people that survived were the ones that were taking the officers ashore in the longboats. And also, I should tell you, there was one other job going on board the ship just before the ship blew up. They were, a bomb ketch had come alongside to take out a mortar. They were taking this weapon out of the ship and transporting it back to Portsmouth. So there was some of the crew had gone on board the ketch. So there's only a few people from the Edgar that weren't on board the ship when it blew up. Everyone that was on board went down with the ship, and it went down very quickly, apparently.
So you said that it was charted on the chart that you mentioned, and that McKee became aware of it. But and this rekindled your interest in the whole thing. How did you manage to relocate it?
It's like a detective story. So I took McKee's book, and I thought, right, the first thing to do is find this chart where it has X marks the spot, Mary Rose, Royal George, Edgar. A friend of mine, Kester Keatley, who's an ex-Mary Rose diver, had scanned all the old charts, the archive that was with the Mary Rose, and he had given me that scan of the chart. So I just georeferenced that chart, put it into ArcGIS, and tried to make it fit, you know, with the coastline now. Now, it's difficult to get old charts to fit perfectly. So I knew that although it's giving me a rough location for the wreck, it's probably not, you know, it's going to be within, you know, it might be within, you know, 50 to 100 metres. So that was the first thing. And then I came across some multi-beam data that was publicly available, Channel Coastal Observatory. And it had, you know, wasn't super high res, but it had a multi-beam image of Spithead Anchorage. And I could see that in the vicinity of the position of the Edgar on that old chart, that there were two mounds, roughly a metre higher than the surrounding seabed. And the surrounding seabed there is very much like the Mary Rose. It's quite flat and very soft mud. And these two mounds just sort of stuck out. So this was about 10 years ago that we're, you know, first started looking into this. And we dived the area from the NAS, the Nautical Archaeology Society Dive Club's rib. And when we hit the seabed, it was dark. You could push your whole arm into the mud. It's a bit of a nasty environment. It's not a friendly environment.
No, and it's not sounding very exotic, Dan. It's not sounding very exotic.
Oh, and the other thing is, although you're in the naval anchorage, you're in nearly 30 metres of water. We were diving at that time about 28 metres. And you're very close to the main shipping channel where you've got the biggest container ships in the world heading up to Southampton.
This really doesn't sound like much fun.
But this is what adds to the excitement, and this is what we love. Anyway, I hit the bottom and we all came up, and I thought, you know what? You know, we did our circular searches, but it was a fairly, although it was a flat seabed, it's kind of lumpy and it seemed to have craters in it. Couldn't find anything. It seemed a little bit too deep as well, because on the old charts, it said the ship was in 13 and a half fathoms, which is about 25 metres. And we were in 28. So I thought, right, although we've dived the position that I've seen on the chart, we're obviously a little bit too deep. There's nothing to see visually on the seabed. We need to do
literally.
Literally. We need to do some more geophysics. So move on another 10 years. And I was talking to Mark Dunkley at Historic England and said, look, I've done this research for these sites. I've narrowed down the search area, but we need to go back to do some geophysics to really kind of pinpoint it. Would you have any spare cash lying around that might be able to fund a boat for me to get out there? Because Dave Park, I was working at Bournemouth at the time. I know I'm rambling on at the moment, but it all sort of fits. Dave Park met an ex-student that was at Plymouth University, who's a hydrographer. He works for Plymouth Uni Hydrography Department, and they've got state-of-the-art multi-beam equipment and mag. And he said he would give his time and bring the equipment. So I was like, well, this is brilliant, great. So I've got a surveyor and I've got the equipment. I can give my time at Bournemouth. Dave said, look, you know, you can go off and do this. So I said to Mark Dunkley, I said, look, we can match fund this by my time, Adam's time, and all of this very expensive equipment. Can you just give me enough money for a week to go out and hire a boat? And he said, yes. We've got to start diving. I thought, start with the mounds and start with the biggest one first and then move along until we find something. I wanted to find something that we could either see or feel. So we moved on.
So presumably you need to find something. Okay, you've got the location, you've got the charts, you've got the description, it all sort of seems to be adding up. But presumably you need something a little bit more tangible, either a gun of that era, the ship's bell, of course, that would be rather nice, wouldn't it? But I'm sure that's like needle in haystack. You need something tangible to connect it, don't you?
Exactly. And this was the greatest challenge. So the next stage was to ground truth these anomalies. And this all happened last year. So we did the geophysics in 2020. And then I set out a plan to dive 2021, summer of 2021, booked the boat and everything. And then in August 2020, I was on a job in the Goodwin Sands and I get a bend.
Yeah, I remember that. That was not good. Yeah.
It was a bend not through doing anything wrong. It was the bend was because I had a hole in the heart. The next year, diving for me was out. So I had to plan all the diving from the surface and get other people to do it.
Oh, God, that must have been frustrating.
Well, you know what it's like, isn't it? When you're running projects, you want to be...
In the water.
In the water. But, you know, I thought, you know what? I've got lots of, you know, great people around. Rachel, Rodrigo, etc. Great divers. I knew there's plenty of people that could do a brilliant job. So book the boat for June, get the whole team together. And then literally a day before I need to be on the boat, Rachel and I both get COVID.
Ah.
So the challenge gets even greater. I've got to now try and direct the diving from at home on the telephone. So I said to Rodrigo, can you take control of this for me? And he did, of course, and did a fantastic job. But I was literally ringing him up going, come on, what's going on? And so I said, right, dive site one, which was the biggest mound, which was 40 metres long, 20 metres wide, and it had a big magnetic target at one end. He goes down, dives it with other members of the team, and they lay a baseline down. And the idea was lay a baseline north-south, and you search off each side of the baseline. I said, look, take down some long poles to probe into the mud, because there might not be anything exposed. It might just be below the surface. Because it's, if you remember when McKee found the Mary Rose, the only thing sticking up were three sort of stumps from frames. So it was mainly buried. But look what happened. Turns into half the ship. Anyway, after the first dive or first two dives, they all came up and said, look, they were probed away and they couldn't feel anything at all. So absolutely zilch. And so I was pretty disappointed, but said, right, move on to site two. And site two was a smaller mound, about 20 metres, 25 metres long and 10 metres wide, 10, 15 metres wide. But it was closer to the position on the chart. And it did have some stronger magnetic targets. Anyway, Rodrigo rings me up saying, really excited, going... And this was actually on day two, during almost the last dive. He's saying, I went down with Heather and everywhere we stuck in a probe, we hit something solid. And he also found a large concretion on the surface. And he said he was sticking his hand in the mud and feeling he could feel archaeology underneath the mud. So that, I thought, brilliant.
Exciting.
All right, site two is the site. This is the site, but we still had nothing tangible. And this year I could dive.
Yay, fantastic.
What I wanted to do was go back to the area that Rodrigo had found where he was probing and he could feel the archaeology. He said that he could feel, actually one of the other divers said that he could feel a pulley block, a wooden block underneath the mud. So I thought, and they left a probe where that block was. So my job was, well, I'll go down and I'll do a circular search and I'll find that probe that they left in the mud. Anyway, I go down and of course I don't find the probe and I'm swimming around and I'm going, oh my God, this is a nightmare. It's dark, it's dingy. I'm trying to feel for archaeology, and I'm just pushing in the probe and not really feeling much. And I'm getting close to the end of my dive. So I thought, you know, I've got a boat full of people that are expecting me to find some archaeology. Anyway, I give it one more last go, and I probe close to the shot, and I start feeling something hard. So I was like, time's running out. This is going to have to be it. So I stick my probe in, leave a line to it, come back up, and I say to everyone, look, I'm really sorry. I couldn't find what we thought was a pulley block from last year. I think I found some hard contacts close to the shot. Go down and just give it a go. Rodrigo went in with another chap called Tom, and I wasn't expecting much. Anyway, 40 minutes later, they come up just grinning, going, we've got archaeology. We can feel it. We've got this massive, like, pulley sheath that we can feel just beneath the surface. And underneath that, we can feel timber, structure. So I was like, I can't believe it. I've completely lucky and found a spot where we've got some archaeology. So on the last dive, I just said, look, we're going to have to recover it because no one's going to believe us until we get something tangible. So Felix, it came down to the last dive of the last day.
It's always the same, isn't it? It's always the same.
Always, yeah. They managed to say, right, it's almost free, but we need one more dive. So I said to Felix, you know, this is up to you, Felix. You got to go in there and get this.
No pressure.
He succeeds, and he comes up with this amazing pulley block, which was 20. It's a 20-inch. We measured it. It's a 20-inch pulley block. It's known as a shoulder. It's got a special little shoulder. It's called a shoulder block. It's got a specific job on the ship. But also, I have to say, while excavating around that pulley block, I did say to the divers, if you come across any other little pottery fragments, glass fragments, it could help date the wreck. Just put that in your bag as well. And we'll you know, these are all useful, you know, datable artifacts. Anyway, Rodrigo did that, and he put something in his goodie bag, working in muddy condition. You can't exactly see what you're doing. So he put this object that was only as big as your hand into his bag and came up. When we opened up the bag and I'm kind of washing it, I said, Rodrigo, he goes, Dan, I've got something here. And he said, I don't think it's pottery. So I go, okay, what is it? And he goes, I think it's bone.
Oh.
Anyway, I look at it and I was going, oh, I think that's, well, it could be animal bone, but I'm not entirely sure. It might be human.
Yeah, well, you've got quite a few of them down there, haven't you?
Unfortunately. We've got quite a few of them down there. So anyway, I took it to the bone specialists at Bournemouth Uni, and they confirmed it was human. It's the sacrum, it's the lower part of the lumbar region. Now, for me, this was fantastic because we've got a lovely pulley block from a ship, but because we've got human remains, it fits with a ship that with all the crew go down. So for me, this is wonderful that now I can say without doubt, I think we've got the Edgar, because we've got the artifact, but we've also got human remains, which all fits with a ship that blows up, all the crew go down, and I've finally got the tangible evidence that we were looking for. So although we don't have a site where you got guns sticking out and structure coming out, we're finding the archaeology in a layer that's not on the surface, it's buried. It's not stuff that's been chucked over the side and lying on the surface. It's in a deposit. For me, we finally got the tangible evidence. And normally I know that it's not, as archaeologists, we don't want to just recover things for the sake of recovering it. So I felt that it was worth doing. And you have to remember that we've just finished excavating the Invincible. We can conserve them. So, you know, I've got the whole infrastructure to look after the objects. And where we dug the test pit, it just fills in straight away. Immediately, everything's covered over and you wouldn't know that we were there. So in terms of leaving the site, how we found it, we did everything that we...
Dan, I wouldn't expect you to be irresponsible on any level whatsoever. That's really exciting though, isn't it? So what's next? What do you plan to do next? I mean, this could potentially be... Well, I mean, if we compare it with the Mary Rose, you've got a lifetime's plus of work ahead of you. So what, presumably, a staged attack?
Yeah, it's crazy in a way. I mean, we're diving on a site that's buried in very soft, fine mud in dark, dingy conditions, 25 to 27 metres down.
In the middle of a shipping channel.
you know, if you give a notice to mariners, they tend to stay away. And to dive in that location, I had to get permission from the King's Harbour Master. But that, yeah, it's obviously it's a challenging site, and it's like the Mary Rose, it's predominantly buried. And to do anything now, you would have to excavate before that stage, because, I mean, you know how hard it is to excavate, especially in the UK. If something is stable in situ, it's unless you've got a lot of money and good research questions, the preferred or the cheapest option is to just to leave it be. But obviously, as someone interested in the Royal Navy and trying to tell the story of the development of the Royal Navy, you've got amazing preservation here. You know, the problem with shipwrecks that are exposed is that they're vulnerable to the physical and biological environment that eats it to death. So for me, you know, thinking of it as an archaeologist, it's a brilliant opportunity. But I think the first stage, before even thinking about that, because, you know, it's a great undertaking, why not do some sub-bottom geophysics to understand the extent of the buried deposits and maybe the depth of the buried deposits? So we've got to understand that this was a site that not only blew up, it was all, and we haven't really spoken about this, it was salvaged in the 1840s by the Royal Engineers. And they took it from a shipwreck that was 13 and a half feet above the seabed down to bed level. They've taken out the upper structure of the ship. Actually, I would try and argue a point to do sub-bottom across the two mounds and even in the surrounding area to see if we can pick up any guns and things like anchors. I mean, I'm not a sub-bottom specialist. I don't know how easy that is to pick up structure and isolated objects.
No, I think that's definitely the best next step, isn't it? Oh,
I think so.
Amazing. Oh, it's really, really exciting. I mean, it's like, I mean, a potential discovery of magnitudes, really. I mean, that's and it's all about sticking at it, isn't it? And putting those bits of the puzzle together in a way, you know, the previous
the
research.
Together.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's really, really cool. Well, thank you so much, Dan. I really, really enjoyed talking to you. But anyway, you'll have to come back and tell us what happens next as well, so that we can keep our listeners up to date and hopefully hear what the next stage in the story with the Edgar is. So, cool.
Well, thanks very much. And hopefully the podcast will get other people excited and think it's worth funding a sub-bottom survey. So thanks for this opportunity.
Thanks so much, Dan. That's so interesting and so early. Although I have to admit, those dark, sort of very murky waters don't necessarily appeal to me. And then there's the shipping lane and the squidgy mud. Rather you than me, mate. Anyhow, no, I think that the potential is incredible. And I just love the way that you've brought all these pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together to actually locate that shipwreck. So good on you. And thanks very much for sharing this exciting discovery with the Dive and Dig News podcast. We look forward to hearing more in the future. So thanks also to my listeners. So this has been brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. And my name is Professor Lucy Blue. Yes, I have been promoted. And I hope that you'll tune in again soon to the Dive and Dig News podcast. Cheers.